The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Runes, the 2018 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2018. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
If you are thinking that you're in the wrong room, then it's my job over the next several minutes to persuade you that you are indeed exactly where you need to be. You're braving the late afternoon, spending your time with me rather than that pre-dinner siesta. But this is where the feast is. I am Chris Schlecht, and I bring you greetings from Moscow, Idaho, at New St. Andrews College. This is a vision for the everyday classroom. And I'm going to roll through a number of examples to begin with and then to end with about real classroom situations, classroom lessons. And I want to begin with a test question that I gave to 10th graders a couple months ago. I taught a history course to 10th graders over this past semester. I'm often working with college students, and it was great to recalibrate for 10th graders. And so I can give you real authentic lessons and lesson plans that have been test-driven with real authentic 10th graders. Here was one of my test questions. So there was a handout. I had a photocopy of this underwear advertisement, because that's what I do for good times. I rifle through old magazines. And if you know me, you will actually know that that is indeed my idea of a good time. So this is from New Yorker magazine. I was pouring through World War II New Yorker magazines and others, and I came across this advertisement. So I thought, oh, test question. Now, so how did World War II affect women on the home front? Formulate a thesis and support it using this magazine advertisement from the New Yorker, March 13, 1943, page 51. Now, I kind of expected that you could read that text. I provided it for the students, too, because it didn't photocopy well. You two, like thousands of other women, can do men's work without sacrificing one bit of feminine loveliness. The secret is to ensure a lovely line. Be fitted to a form fit, tailored to precision, foundation, girdle, or bra, the better stores have them. And I was really pleased with the results. This was a test question that I had given. Now, one thing that's important to note is that the students had not seen this advertisement before. That wasn't something that we covered in class, but I tested them on it. And that's what I'm going to get into in a little bit more detail and to discuss why I would test on something that I hadn't shown them before. Let me tell you what I have shown them earlier that week. We spent a class period going through a number of slides. And during this class period, I said I was going to stage them for a discussion. All right? So this was a class period earlier in the week. Do you agree or disagree with this claim? The consequence of World War II for women is this. The presence of women in the workforce eroded conventional beliefs about the differences between men and women. And so here we have a photograph taken of women on the factory floor, Rosie the Riveter. You're familiar with that. And I'm from the Pacific Northwest. This is the Boeing plant in Seattle. And they're installing Rolls-Royce Merlin engines, British made, in an assembly in Seattle. So, is this a guy? Now, okay, does she look masculine to you?
No.
No. Some of you said no. Why does she not look masculine to you? Yes. Okay, it's a big room here. She just pointed to makeup and hairstyle, and the students are going to pick up on this. There are other features as well. Recruiting poster, women in the military. women in the military, masculine work, right? She looked like a guy, or she looked, now, I will abridge what I would do in class, but I would dry out the students to make particular observations about this recruiting poster. The story, of course, is that women come into the factory floor for the arsenal of democracy while our men are taking up arms in the Pacific or in Europe during World War II. Right? And so that's the claim, the presence of women in the workforce eroded conventions about how men and women are different. And that lipstick is pretty bright. Join the Marines. And it happens that the U.S. military resources brought in fashion designers in order to try to draw women into the military. They needed to actually reassure them that they're not sacrificing the stitch of femininity. So, yeah, it looks like a guy, right? Students can pull this out here. The girl with the future, lifetime of education for free. Now, here's an advertisement for Q-Tex nail polish. Q-Tex nail polish stays with you whether you're in your evening dress or in the daytime. You're one of the auxiliaries related to the Army, Navy, Air Force, Coast Guard, Marines, and whatever. Elizabeth Arden created a new shade of lipstick, Montezuma Red, expressly designed to go along with epaulets. So this is the story, though. You get women in World War II, the women rushed the factory floor, and so then you get the beginning of second wave feminism, and you know them have the hair to go, right? Is that really true? There's an interesting discussion to be had here. And we had that discussion. And then, so on Friday, I throw this quiz question at them. And from that conversation earlier, then they have to interrogate this source, which is the source they haven't seen. And then they need to parse it, you know, how did women of World War II affect women on the home front? And again, I've supplied the text for it. It is fascinating to me that the advertisement says that thousands of other women like you can do men's work without sacrificing one bit of feminine loveliness. All you need is this undergarment to preserve your womanly demeanor when you're installing Rolls-Royce Merlin engines into whatever plane they went into. So, that's a test question. And I'm going to put that on the shelf for a moment. And I'm going to show you another test, an actual test, that comes from a school that I observed. And got permission to put this up here. It's a great test. So this is from 9th grade European history, and I don't presume that you'd be able to read it. I'm just showing you what it looked like here. But I'm going to take you on a tour of this test. This is actually it's the Chapter 7 test, Rise of Christianity. So, look at question 11. The most scholarly Latin father, apparently, is Jerome. The most scholarly, apparently, that wasn't Augustine. Or it wasn't Tertullian, it was Jerome. And number 12, who influenced Augustine's conversion? Well, Ambrose did. Or Monica, his mother, or his... Now, as I look at this test, I do this when I do some classroom observations, but I'm looking for little signs, little tells in the test. This suggests to me that a student has been trained like a seal at SeaWorld, stimulus response. When presented with stimulus, most scholarly Latin father, response Jerome. Right? So here we go. All of Rome, oh, letter J, very good. Clearly, Rome fell in 476. I'm not sure what that means. And the name of the four letters. that. Anyway, it just goes on and on. Five pillars of Islam, named the four prominent bishoprics of the young Christian church. Clearly, the teacher had given them a roster of facts, and this student, you saw on the front page, the student received an A. That's an extra credit in this garbage, apparently. Three divisions of Clovis's kingdom. Now, this is a question you must answer. What were the reasons for the fall of Rome? I love the definite article. What were the reasons for the fall of Rome? And I'm not going to read you the student's answer, but this is in prose form, and it's a list, except in the form of a paragraph. This is no less a stimulus response, although it's an essay, than some of those others I showed you. Now, here's the next section of the same test. Choose three questions from 1 through 5 to answer. So here's 1 through 5, so you can choose 3. And so, like this student is going to see opted to answer number 4. What were Augustine's three views of history? Here's an essay. In City of God, view 1, view 2, view 3. Stimulus, response, you know, give me the fish, that sort of thing. And this teacher can report that the class performed to a certain level of satisfaction on this test. The students are, it's a nice Christian school, students are compliant, they listen, they pay attention, and they go through these facts. And I would just ask you, what does this test represent? Does this test represent what we want our students to really grow into and be cultivated into? This talk is titled Vision for the Everyday Classroom. And what I want to try to do is get us to think about really what's going on in the concrete every day, but to think about the concrete every day in light of the big picture that we have in mind. We need to distinguish good lessons from poor ones. And one of the ways to distinguish good lessons from poor ones is whether we have lessons that actually support the vision for our school and the vision for what we want our students to become. Do you want your students to become cogs in the economic machinery of society? If that's your vision, then this is a test for you. Follow instructions. I think following instructions is great, right? But I hope you see a difference in these two assessments. And I do think that they're reflective in certain ways of what's going on in the classroom working behind it. The key thing, I think, to remember, and I highlighted this in my last session, when I was speaking yesterday afternoon, that we need to look at what the students are actually doing to assess whether or not a lesson is a good lesson. In my session yesterday, I made the point that teaching is about students. There's the act, learning is an activity that only a student can do. So the teacher's job is important, but the teacher's job is to induce the student to act. To induce the student to act. Okay? Teaching is not about the teacher acting. Teaching is about getting a student to act. Okay? And that action is the action of learning. Okay? That action is the action of learning. And so, if you do classroom observation, I developed this point yesterday, but if you're an administrator doing classroom observations, I hope you do peer observations one to another in your school. But when you're sitting in a classroom, you should preeminently be looking at what the kids are doing. What are the kids doing? And then look secondly at what the teacher's doing in sort of the second place to find a relationship between what the kids are doing and what the teacher's doing. Okay? But it's all about what the kids are doing. And the kids are going to be doing something, and to be passive, docile, non-creative, well-trained seals at SeaWorld, is what these kids are being trained up into. All right. To unpack this further, and I'm going to start moving us toward vision statements here, to distinguish a good lesson from a bad one, I want to introduce a distinction between information, habit formation, and character formation. Information, habit formation, and character formation. When you're looking at what the kids are doing, what the students are doing, are the students doing information? Are they cultivating habits? And are they forming character? Now, information is knowledge bits. What are the dates of the Peloponnesian War? I can see in the back, Allison, here in the back. Now, Dr. Schlecht is going to undergo an examination right now for all of you here. I am richly honored to have an alumnus, a student who I have taught the Peloponnesian War in this room. Allison, what were the dates of the Peloponnesian War?
431 and 442.
Oh, dang. Yeah, she got it. Good. She got the information. And you have to ask me spoiled my illustration, too, because I was expecting that you would miss that question.
I taught it this year.
Yeah, cheating. All right. Usually when it happens, the students can't remember. Okay. And in UC Andrews College, there have been student after student after student that has crossed the rostrum and received a degree. I had taught them, and they knew when they were in my class, the dates of the Peloponnesian War, that they had through the cities. By the time they graduate, all but Allison has forgotten the dates of the Peloponnesian War. Now, if my purpose for them was to inform them, then I failed. And most of my students can't answer that question accurately upon graduation. They usually take my class in sophomore year. Allison spoiled because she's brighter than most of our alums. She's not bright. But I think you understand the point of it. Okay. Information, those are the knowledge bits. This would include, I'm a history guy, names and dates. What's the atomic number of carbon or its atomic mass? Sometimes information gets more sophisticated. What factors played into the changing of Elizabeth Bennet's mind and attitude toward Mr. Darcy? And what factors played into that? That's information. You have sophisticated or simple information. But it's information. All right? And that test that I was putting up was largely about information, the second test, much less the first. Then there are habit formation, and I'll tell you that first example that I gave the form fit ad, that's really what I was after here with that ad. Habit formation. Habits are repeated behaviors. Behaviors repeated to the point where they become instinct. So when you get into a car, what do? You think about it? I bet when you were in driver's ed, you thought about it. But now when you get into a car, it's a seatbelt key, you get yourself oriented, check the mirrors, maybe with me it's move the seat because my wife was in there previously and I don't want to eat my knees for dinner. I am taller than she is. But those are just habitual things, and I don't think about them, but there was certainly a time when I thought about it. Okay? How does a major league shortstop become proficient at his craft? At, say, turning double plays. Okay. The bounding ball comes to him, he gathers it up very quickly, throws it to the second baseman, and in turn throws it to the first double play. And a bounding ball again and again and again. I would suggest to you that Derek Jeter, an outstanding shortstop, probably fielded more grounders than were actually hit to him in a game context. He becomes proficient because it's just seamless. What's interesting about this bounding ball that comes to a shortstop is that everyone, like a snowflake, is unique. And if you're a baseball fan, you know what I'm talking about. There is no, There are no two exactly the same bounding balls, with their difference in pace, their difference in spin, their difference in angle and height of bounce. No two are exactly alike. Yet at the same time, there is a muscle memory that engages that can take someone who is really excellent to just do that without thinking. In fact, if they have to think, it would be a major league shortstop. Okay. It's become a habit. Now, you can analyze it. You can actually describe the physics of it. But I would suggest to you that Derek Jeter didn't become a shortstop that he became because he was in a physics classroom with a whiteboard and the analysis, the balances and angles and that sort of thing. Okay. So you've got information, but you've got habits. Now, when trouble comes, like a hard hit ball, what do you do? What comes out habitually? When an intellectual challenge comes, what comes out and what do habitually? Can you recognize the nature of the challenge and deploy the right response? And is that how your habits are tailored? In education, there is some information, but also habit formation. And we need to keep that in mind. And then there's character formation. Character formation gets our students' inclinations, affections, the order of their loves, the kinds of people they're becoming. Okay. So I would invite you to think about what happens in the classroom with these three sort of scales of analysis or frames of reference, however you want to refer to them, in mind. Information, habit formation, character formation. Now what's interesting here is I got onto the internet and I decided that I would go to some ACCS schools and pull vision statements off of the web. And it just so happens that some Veritas people are here. This was on stage. But this is the vision statement for Veritas School in Richmond, Virginia. And I could have chosen a host of, there's a lot of wonderful vision statements. And I'm going to read through the vision statement, but before I do, I'm going to ask a question. Does this ever show up in a lesson plan or a classroom? And if it did, would you know that it did? Like, oh, that was the vision statement that arrived. Would you recognize it? What does it smell like? What's its shape? How would you see it if it passed through? And if the vision statement showed up in the classroom like this, and here's something that I would suggest. Remember the possible ways of fielding ground balls. If it showed up in the sense of, okay, class, we're going to have a lesson on the vision statement, like, okay, class, here is the physics of the bounding ball and the shortstop. If it showed up like that, you're probably not achieving the vision. Curious. How does it show up in the classroom? And I hope, and isn't this the idea? This is what we're trying to get at with the outcome. Does this ever show up in the classroom? And again, what would it look like if it did? A conversation about the vision statement is probably the last way to achieve the vision statement. All right, it's a great vision statement. We exist to glorify God by cultivating students of wisdom and virtue through a Christ-centered, academically rigorous classical education. Our goal is to equip students with the knowledge, skills, and vision necessary to be effective leaders and servants for Christ in a wide variety of professions and vocations. We seek to raise up a generation of young people who have a genuine love of learning, who love Jesus Christ with all their hearts and minds, and who can articulate the Christian message with clarity, creativity, and power. That show up in the classroom. Just putting that out as a question here. Here's another one. Trinitas, ACCS school. This is a very, very important school because my daughter is marrying one of its graduates in 2 weeks. We graduate classically educated ladies and gentlemen with abiding faith in whose lives, works are joyfully submitted to the Lord Jesus Christ. There's a vision statement. Very good. Now, how are you going to find out whether you're attaining your vision? Well, one way is if one of your graduates has the good sense to marry Krishna's daughter. And then they're like, well, okay, he's being the rich, but anyway. But that's probably, I only have so many daughters to go on with that. This is my last daughter to marry. So that, as a rubric, is unavailable to the rest of you. So we need to come up with some other way of assessing. And I can say that I'm truly grateful for the class of Christian education that my children-in-law are receiving too. It's fascinating to me that my children, I have now, I'm going to have four children. I have five children in all. This is my fourth to be married, and they're all marrying people who received classical Christian education, which is more like. So there we go. That's a good sign. But you're not going to be a matchmaker in the 10th grade. That's not the lesson plan either. So, one of the things the Trinitas did, and I appreciate this, so there's their vision statement, but then they also unpack it. It's a lot of words for a slide, but I'll read it for you here. We aim to graduate young men and women who think clearly and listen carefully with discernment and understanding, who reason persuasively and articulate precisely, who are capable of evaluating their entire range of experience in the light of the scriptures, and do so with eagerness and joyful submission to God. We desire them to recognize cultural influences as distinct from biblical, and be unswayed towards evil by the former. We aim to find them well prepared in all situations, possessing both information and the knowledge of how to use it. We desire they be socially graceful and spiritually gracious, equipped with and understanding the tools of learning, desiring to grow in understanding and fully realizing the limitations and foolishness of the wisdom of the world. We desire they have heart for the lost and the courage to seek to dissuade those who are stumbling toward destruction, that they distinguish real religion from religion in form only, that they possess the former, knowing and loving the Lord Jesus Christ, and all these we desire them to possess with humility and gratitude to God. Now, returning to my question, does this ever show up in the classroom, and how do we do so? I would suggest, first of all, that pressing that question is a project that we all need to be engaged in. And I certainly can't say, oh, that's easy. Here's how it shows up in the classroom. Let me give you three steps. You know that I would be pulling wool over your eyes if I gave you three easy steps to implementing this in the classroom. But nonetheless, we need to be minded that way. We need to be minded that way. That distinction between information, habit formation, and character formation, I think, is helpful to form a vocabulary that can help us translate from our board-approved vision statements to the classroom. It's a sort of a vocabulary that can be served somewhat, in some sense, as an intermediary. Okay? And imagine many of you need to look at your vision statements. Perhaps maybe you want to revise them or to unpack them with some of these questions in mind. Are they unpackable? Now, one of the things that we've developed at the college level, at New St. Andrews College, is to describe the habits that we want our students to embody. And as I look at many of the vision statements, many of you do have something like this about reasoning persuasively and logic, rhetoric, and things like that. And so we have, as a faculty, worked on this to try to identify intellectual habits. This is what we came up with. I've recorded them for you in the outline that you have in your notebooks. But rhetoric here, the ability to communicate with clarity, precision, and aesthetic persuasiveness. Dialectic, the ability to draw distinctions and connections, to analyze and synthesize, to induce and deduce. Perspective, a humble understanding of oneself and one's opponents, of the limitations of one's own understanding, without that humility leading to relativism. Observation, the ability to pay close attention to various levels of detail. Process, the ability to see a problem and to then develop an intelligent process for going about finding a solution, and imagination, creative mind, which is eager to look for new ways of telling the story, of solving the problem, intellectual curiosity, and a habit or practice of copiousness. These are habits. These are behaviors. Maybe you can think of them as skills, but they're intellectual skills that can only be nurtured through practice. Through practice rather than through a one-off explanation. In fact, a one-off explanation couldn't do it. You form these habits the same way the shortstop learns how to execute a double play. That's how you form habits like this. But these are intellectual habits. I would encourage you as an exercise, perhaps with your faculty together with the administration, to work on a document like this that's informed by your mission statement, but then something will help you translate into the classroom, sort of this intermediary between your vision statement and the classroom. I think ours probably stands for to revise, but then, so these would be the intellectual habits, and then the character traits, intellectual character traits. Courage, not brash fearlessness, but a conviction that what must be done or said will be done or said, regardless of the opposition. It will create unflustered and undistracted by a personal panic or others venting their emotions. Toughness. Intolerance directed toward self for convenient excuses, resulting in perseverance and dependability, a disposition to see trials and challenges as opportunities, and a readiness to assume responsibility. Initiative, the free man's ability to drive himself to complete tasks without a master standing over, the ability to push himself into new ventures without hand-holding, resulting in a desire to be more than an appreciator, but a doer and a creator. Intellectual integrity and intolerance for inconsistencies and patience for mysteries. Zeal, a godly hunger for the advance of God's kingdom, an evangelical loyalty, a deep and abiding loyalty to and confidence in the gospel and the faithful church, a love for God and for neighbor, a hunger for holiness and the fruits of the Spirit. So, these are character ideals that we have sort of unpacked. You can have a vision statement, but then we're looking for a vocabulary that can actually start to cash out in the classroom. So intellectual character attributes and intellectual habits. And if you're minded, oriented toward these sorts of things, then you're going to be, I would suggest, less concerned about what the dates are of the Peloponnesian War, and more concerned about, is it the game? Is it an actual baseball game a better test than a shortstop? Now, the shortstop might go through all kinds of drills to become who he is, but the game is the real test. Can you actually do it? Can you display these virtues? And you're going to display them in a level of immaturity and then increasing maturity. There's Little League, and then there's American Legion ball, and then there's Major Leagues. But that's how habits go. What I'm going to do for you is to barrage you with a few examples, more of lessons that I deliver to students, and then to try to show you what my thinking is behind the design of the lessons to try to fulfill what it is that I'm describing here. I think an example is one of the best ways that I can think of to try to get at this. So this was a quiz that I gave to my 10th graders. And this is similar to what I had given them. You can tell that I was dealing with U.S. history with 10th graders. And you can tell that I'm dealing with U.S. history with 10th graders. And it's late 20th century. So I gave them this essay on a quiz. Examine the five primary sources attached, none of which they had seen. Okay. And a well-crafted essay, assert a thesis statement, and defend it by using any three of the sources as supporting evidence. Your thesis statement must assert something that was true, important, and unique about American life back in the 1950s and 60s. Take care and fully explain how each of the three sources supports your thesis. So I'm going to give them five sources, and so they're sitting down for the quiz, and they've got this packet of five sources. I actually have them in overhead so they can see what they look like in color, too, because it was a black and white photocopy. The first one was a brochure for Levittown, Pennsylvania, 1957. I gave it to them in a copy where they can make out the writing. Document two is a Lipton soup ad. Lipton soup gives you fresh home cooked taste. That's from 1958. The third source was a letter to the editor of the Hartford Courant, and also a comic book issue from DC Comics, crime suspense stories. The students haven't seen this. We haven't even talked about comic books. Synopsis, I provide them with a synopsis of the story. The story synopsis of this issue, a man dismembers his wife and buries the pieces of her body in his backyard. His lover has plastic surgery in order to stand in for his wife. The couple gets tickets to a quiz show called Treasure Hunt, and they're selected to be contestants, and the host informs them that, you get to find the treasure, and we buried it in your backyard, and your backyard is being dug up right now. And that's how the comic ends. This letter to the Hartford Courant, which I hadn't presented to the students before, is presenting, it's a letter of outrage about the state of comic books in the 1950s and juvenile delinquency. This is an article from the New York Times, 1959, when rock and roll singer Chuck Berry was arrested and jailed for violating the miscegenation laws. He was arrested for allegedly dating a white girl. He said, "No, you misunderstood. We're just friends. There's no romance involved." And so that's the New York Times article from 1959 describing that. Then the next source, the fifth source, is a Fallout Shelter handbook. So there we go. There's the quiz. You need to pick three, any three, and you need to create an argument to assert a meaningful thesis, and that argument must be fully supported by the three sources that you interrogate and develop and fold into whatever argument that you create. I was really pleased with how the students performed. I think that this is a far better test than what are the dates of the Peloponnesian War. They hadn't seen any of these sources before. They did pretty well. I'll read you, here's a 10th grader's essay. You can see how they did. This one was a fair one. It wasn't the best one, but this one was decent. The life of the average American in the late 1950s and early 60s was filled with fear and apprehension, especially concerning the future of the nation. That is, the United States of America faced peril from many different sources, such peril that had potential to pull apart and ravage the nation entirely. It was notions like these that were the origin of this pertinent time throughout media in all forms. This was an in-class essay, too, so some of the grammar is a little wobbly. First and perhaps foremost, the American people feared attack and invasion. Primary source of this concern arrived from across the globe in communist-controlled USSR. Many Americans remembered World War II and the damage it caused and the legacy that the conflict left in its wake. Specifically, the American people feared the same fate that had befallen Japan, nuclear warfare. The USSR was now also in possession of nuclear weapons that had great potential to be turned toward North America. The reaction that resulted from this threat is littered throughout the period's history in the form of advertisements, admonitions, etc. Many people considered investing in a safe shelter from nuclear attack, and so reference to the source. Several attempts were made, however, in the feasibility of such a shelter. Several assumptions were made in the feasibility of such a shelter. The main one being that if you already lived in such a place as to have enough land on which to house such a shelter. More specifically, in this case, you must have been and inhabited what was known as the suburbs. These types of communities grew as the nuclear threat did. Migration away from large cities that may have been considered targets for a nuclear event. That was okay, but I appreciate this as a 10th grader, and I appreciate this as a good effort. But this was not the only reason that many people were leaving cities or suburbs. Cities also posed a threat to the children that inhabited them in regard to the formation of gangs. Parents thought it safer to raise a family outside of the city, away from peer pressure in all forms, including that of entertainment. If they could get the children far from the source of evil, the evil genres of music and comic books, then they would be able to live out the American dream as they sought to. However, there were complications to this. Despite everyone's best efforts, the products of the good of the gold-plated sewers of New York are substituted in, or are described in Hartford through the design of local merchants. And so, and then there's a quote that I'm having a hard time reading as writing. You can see what the student's dealing with that Hartford Current article there. No matter where they went or what they did, the American people were surrounded by the dangers and fears that came with modern society. To them, it seemed inescapable. So that was in class, confronted with these sources that they hadn't seen, and about a half hour to do this, half hour students work. Now, it could be better. There's room for improvement. This also offers the opportunity for me to speak into the students, giving them feedback. And then up here is an excellent essay. What did the excellent essay have that the others didn't? I thought it was a pretty good exercise. So, building skills. What kind of intellectual habits are we forming? And then some even character traits are we forming? Confronted with a problem. Sources I haven't seen. I only have one. There were other sections of the test of scientists. This is like about 30 minutes to do this, to read all these sources, to digest them, to select three of them, to come up with a thesis, to draw upon what I know, produce an analysis. That's pressure. And that's the kind of pressure that's good practice, and it's this type of performance that you can get meaningful feedback into. Varying degrees of excellence and improvement are available. Again, that was a pretty good essay, so it was interesting to see the thesis. Some students talked about women and women in the suburbs. The woman who was dating Chuck Berry and the Lipton soup and the convenience culture of the suburbs. It was really interesting to see what the students came up with. I'm not reading the same essay again and again. That's another benefit. Let's read these essays all together, and one person's talking about the Cold War, another person's talking about children, another person's talking about women, another person's, it's fun to see what they're going to come up with. So that was the outcome. Developing intellectual habits. I think a much better exercise. This was a slide I actually pulled off. I put in front of the students on the day I handed it back. I said, "So look at the prompt that I gave you." These said, "Look at your own essays." And this is how I graded them, the criteria that I used. Can the reader identify a thesis statement readily? And is the thesis statement meaningful? I.e., the student asserts something about the 1950s and 60s that was fairly unique about the 1950s and 60s. Here, there were some students who said, there were many anxieties in the 1950s and 60s. What do you all think about that thesis statement, class? Were there many anxieties in the 1850s and 60s? Many anxieties. So is that a meaningful, you can prove that thesis that there were anxieties in the 50s and 60s, 1950s and 60s, right? That's not a meaningful thesis statement because it's true of just about any era. You had to get something peculiar, the suburbs, what was happening with the Cold War. So that's going to get you, that's going to be a thesis that you can cash out a little bit more. And then sources, did you cite three sources? And what matters about the source, I'm looking for this, is identified and explained. You don't simply shoehorn one of the sources in because I told you to cite three. You need to interrogate the source and show that there's something concrete in the source that supported it, and then you connect it to the thesis. So you deal with three sources, what matters about the source, you mention that, and then how it's relevant, you cover that. And I said, there you go. And so I'm explaining to them, I would submit to you that there are a host of intellectual habits that are being cultivated in this. There's one I just read for you. All right, here's another assignment that I gave. And I told you I'm just going to give you some examples. This is Schleck brainstorming ways that I work with students. But, some lesson plans that I thought were successful. So this was a group assignment. I had given the students a couple of primary documents. One was a speech that was given for an advocate of boarding schools in Native American reservations. And another one was a government report on the condition of Native American reservations about 2 decades later. And that's all they had in these sources. We didn't go through the sources, walk through them. What I did is I said, here's the sources, and here's your assignment. We didn't even discuss the sources, except to give them, I gave them maybe about a 2 minute orientation of what they were. We didn't read them together. All right, in groups of four, I divided the group. We had 20 kids in the class, divided the kids 5 groups of four. Prepare and perform a skit of 5 to 7 minutes, which represents life in an Indian school, draw inspiration from Pratt's speech and excerpts from the 1928 Marion Report, and creatively represent the following issues. So in your skit, I want to see these issues, white and Indian perspectives, the problems that boarding schools aim to solve, and why, and so forth, what actually occurred in the schools, and what happened to family life, routines, and so forth. All right. So I want to see those issues in the skits. Group one, here's your scenario. Indian family learns that a son or daughter is heading off to a boarding school. They prepare for the son or daughter's departure and see him or her away as she leaves on a bus. So you need the characters or the son or the daughter, the government Indian agent working on the reservation, and relatives. Okay, so you're going to do a skit of someone leaving, seeing reservation, and someone's leaving for boarding school. Group two, Indian parents travel from the reservation to the boarding school, see the school, and have a parent-teacher conference. All right? And then the characters, teacher, students, and so forth. Group three, confusing class of cultures during a mild classroom exchange at the Indian school. Afterwards, both teachers and students discuss their take on what had occurred. You need to come up with, what would it look like if you got Indian kids going to boarding school and a class of culture that occurs in a classroom? They develop a skit about it that needs to show the issues that I described and draw inspiration from the sources that I give. Group four. Your skit needs to be a class of cultures where the students from an Indian boarding school travel to a city. The students are either on a field trip or they're team members for a sporting event. Like an Indian school kid team is playing some white school kid team. Do a skit. There you go. Draw the sources. And then group five, the Indian student returns to the reservation after a few years boarding school. And so then the kids get together, they read through the sources, mine the sources for data points, come up with characters and ideas, and then we run the skits, and the skits were like 10, 15 minutes apiece. The kids were having fun with it. Now, alternatively, I could have said, okay, kids, take out your notes. We're going to have a unit on the American West, and we're going to talk about Indian-white relations in the American West, heading one, very important point, Indian reservations, really? Schlecht can talk a whole lot about what's going on in the American West, and the students can dutifully take down key points. But I want them to grab the wheel of the car and start taking that car for a drive. The teacher needs to get the students to take some driving lessons And for the driving lesson, you got to get out of the classroom and get behind the wheel. And of course, a good driver's teacher might have the brake on the passenger side and might be ready to grab that wheel. That's what teachers are for. But you never want a driver to go out in the real world unless they have some practice, right? And some practice finding things out, figuring this out. They have to perform a skit here. I like using sports analogies a lot because I think, I honestly believe this, that teachers who pay attention to coaches, coaches of winning teams, can learn a lot of lessons about what ought to happen in a classroom. Okay? The coach is not suiting up for the big game. The kids are suiting up for the big game. We have to remember that, right? You have to remember that. And so a good coach understands that the kids are suiting up for the big game, so what happens in practice is designed to equip the kids to do it themselves. Get the kids to do it themselves. Don't teach anything that they can figure out for themselves. But you, of course, you don't, I'm not into unschooling, so send the kids off to the abyss. You know, you provide structure, you provide a prompt, you provide stimulation, you provide resources. You know, you provide the car, and you might give them a little prompt about the rules of the road, but they've got to take that wheel, don't they? They've got, how else are you going to learn to drive a stick shift unless you start playing around with the clutch and the brake and moving it yourself? And that is going to form the intellectual habits that we want to cultivate in our students that will help us to achieve our goal for them in our school's vision statements. All right. So I think it's always a good practice for lesson plans to be submitted to an administrator. The plan for this was submitted by a principal, and this is kind of the Oz behind the curtain where I am producing objectives that I had in mind for that previous lesson. So, I want students to explain these key concepts, compare the mainstream treatment of racial minorities in the South versus the West following the Civil War, blacks in the South versus Chinese and Native Americans in the West. And I did this skit to catch the Native American component. I had another exercise to talk about what happened with the blacks, as what Jim Crow said he had following the Civil War. And then I've got skill cultivation. I'm trying to be mindful of, here's the information that we're working with, but are we working with that information in a way that's cultivating these habits and skills? But I'm after students will collaborate in groups to develop fictional historical reenactment. Students will interrogate period sources to draw informed conclusions about the past. I have that again and again and again, especially as a history teacher. Students are they developing the skills to interrogate sources to draw meaningful conclusions. Very, very important. And I can show this to my administrator. Oftentimes, this is really just a benefit to me to keep myself grounded. Like, why am I here? Am I here to announce to the students how much I have learned about the American West? Or am I a teacher trying to get the students to learn, which means they need to start doing and enacting and performing the behavior of learning? All right. I have students, I call it the museum assignment, where the students need to go off to the libraries, pull together primary sources. This one is on Dracula, and zeroing in, the student's interpretive text down on the bottom reads this. During the most abysmal years of the Great Depression, horror films like Dracula began creeping into the cinema spotlight. These monster films provided metaphors for what many Americans sensed at the time, that they were not completely in control of their lives, but that there were unknown and powerful forces at work, namely unemployment and bankruptcy. However, while the horror films did portray the monsters that people faced every day in the 1930s, they were also redemptive. The monster was always defeated in the end. This is why many Americans were drawn to them. It gave them hope and it gave them a way to escape their problems. I was on a student's board about Dracula, and the student has actually found an old article writing up about the Dracula movie on the left and calling attention to certain things that were said in the article or the referencing the Depression context and that sort of thing. The student is contextualizing Dracula. And this was a student's choice of topic. I didn't go through Dracula with them. The students all found their own topics to talk about, to put these words together. And I gave them certain prescriptions to do so. So here's a student who talked about Louis Armstrong. Did Louis Armstrong, the jazz, we didn't talk about jazz, we didn't talk about Louis Armstrong, we didn't talk about the Cold War in class. And this student came up with a great take on Louis Armstrong about, I'll read a portion of it. As the United States and the Soviet Union competed for the friendship of foreign nations during the Cold War, each sought any and every opportunity to tarnish the reputation of the other. The discrimination against African Americans in the United States gave the Soviets the perfect ammunition. U.S. officials realized that in order to remain a champion of freedom in the eyes of the world, it was crucial for America to rid itself of its racist reputation. One way the U.S. retaliated was by creating the Jazz Ambassadors Program, made of prominent and, importantly, African American musicians, including the King of Jazz himself, Louis Satchel Armstrong. And it goes on to talk about the jam ambassadors who went on this tour funded by the Pentagon to try to convince especially the developing world that we were actually friendly to racial minorities because the communists were saying that the U.S. doesn't promise freedom to you. This has nice connections to what was going on in Little Rock and so forth. So that's when a student does work like that on topics that we didn't talk about, I find myself kind of pleased with, like, we're getting somewhere now. Students are finding connections themselves. Here's another one. One student chose, this surprised me, this student grew up reading Maurice Sendak's Where the Wild Things Are. And so here's what the student says, here's the display. In that interpretive text, it says, in 1964, Where the Wild Things Are, when the Caldecott Bell soon became a classic, and that's and the wild things became cultural icons. The author Maurice Sendak's success peaked in the 1960s when the baby boomers were coming into their own as young adults. America turned to look at its newest generation. As it did, cultural perceptions of children were changing. Despite controversy, critics hailed Sendak as a children's champion, respect that had been reserved for adult art and literature began to creep into the world of children's literature. Sendak's themes of children's independence and so on and so forth. So you see on the left side, there's the Beatles and rock and roll and all kinds of stuff about self-expression and counterculture. And the center of it is Where the Wild Things Are. And reviews, and the student had done all kinds of reviews, found some period reviews of where some of these comments were made at the time in the 1960s, some research skills too. Anyway, those are some examples of lessons that I would suggest to you are the fruit of intellectual habits pretty well formed now. Now, these displays were mature students, but this is the kind of thing we want students to make connections on their own, to think on their own, to discover on their own in a disciplined, channeled way, and to describe and articulate it on their own so they can take the wheel. So the point is that I would encourage you to try to think creatively in the classroom, think creatively about getting the students to do work, equipping them to do work, sort of step by step, to cultivate intellectual habits and virtues, rather than simply memorizing a list of reasons why Rome may or may not have fallen. Thank you very much. You're a great group. And I hope you'll come to the concert tonight with my colleague, Dr. Kurt, directing. But anyway, I'm happy to field any questions up front, but I'll let you all be listening.